Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. Today, I'll be speaking with Alsinosi Adam about the hunger crisis in Sudan, which many fear may soon blow up into full-scale famine. Listeners may recall former guest Mariam Al-Faqi, who spoke to us about Sudan's famed resistance committees and how they transformed themselves into local humanitarian responders when the war broke out. Sinosi is a spokesperson for the emergency rooms, or the ERRs as they are often called, and he's on the show to give us an update on the situation on the ground in Sudan and what, if any, aid is getting through to the people there. Sinosi, thanks so much for coming on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Alan.
So we have a lot to discuss today. Unfortunately, our podcasts on Sudan are grimmer and grimmer. First, Sinosi, can you tell us more about the network of Sudanese local responders you are part of, the so-called emergency rooms? How are they responding to this horrific crisis in Sudan?
Yeah, so the emergency response room is a grassroots organization, voluntary based. We have over 1,000 volunteers in Sudan. Our structure is we have a council of representatives elected from their districts and from their localities who are from the smallest level, from like the smallest ER would be like 15 to 20 volunteers in a neighborhood. And then they will link with the other ERs in the district. All these districts together, they have a council. And then all the localities, they also have a council. And then we have technical offices in each ER. We have the programs, we have the protection office, we have finance, we have reporting, we have the medical office, the women co-ops. It's a very huge network. We started very small in Khartoum, and then we moved on to the rest of the states, to Bahri, to Omdurman, Al Jazeera, Sinnar, and Al Obeid, and in the five states of Darfur.
Okay, so could you start telling us about the situation facing Sudanese right now on the ground? Let's start with the greater Khartoum area, the so-called Tri-City area, which includes Bahri, Omdurman, and Khartoum, the three cities making up generally the capital. What's like for Sudanese who remain there on the ground right now?
Well, I mean, the Tri-City area is where the battle is the fiercest, right? And where it's like a contested area between the SAF and the RSF. A lot of neighborhoods are under siege. Goods, for example, don't get in. For example, SAF will not allow food items, for example, to get from their side into RSF territory. And RSF will do the same. They will not allow food items coming from, for example, Madani and those areas to enter to SAF territories. And now in these territories, there are people, thousands of families in these places have been trapped. First of all, they don't have money. And they rely on these communal kitchens that the ERs provide, most of them. And now with the lack of supplies coming into these areas, it's an imminent threat of a famine in the capital city.
Hmm. How is the situation in the other areas where you guys are operating, the other war-affected areas? You mentioned Jazeera, Sennar, Darfur, and the Kordofan areas.
In the rest of these areas, the threat is literally about the needs being met, but it's not about the actual lack of supplies. Darfur had been through an issue, but I think now with the resuming of supplies coming from Chad by WFP and other organizations, if these supplies have been made available for the people there and stuff like that, we can dodge a bullet there. In Sinnar, you can still bring things from Damazin, from Sinjar. You can buy stuff from other places and bring it in. With the RSF actually controlling Madani, I'm not sure if that already started to happen or not. But if they, because there's the Gadarif is like the basket of food in Sudan, if there is supplies going, for example, to White Nile State, towards Kordofan, they will come through Madani. And with the Arabs of controlling that route, it will also gradually create a lack of supplies for these places. Sinnar is okay in terms of the supplies, like you can source them. Yes, they're very expensive, but you can source them. And our emergency room in Sinnar, they've been doing a wonderful job there. Al Ubayd, however, we really, like, nobody gave us money for Al Ubayd. We don't know what to do there. I mean, we have our rooms there. People are just communally chipping in and bringing things together, but the scale of the work in Al Ubayd is very limited. It's like 4 communal soup kitchens in Sheikhan locality, but with no funding at all.
And so outside the Tri-City area, it sounds like the markets are functioning. Is the problem that people basically don't have the money to buy the food?
Yeah, that's mainly the problem. I mean, the food is very expensive, but it's there for now. Inside the tri-state, it's a different story at all.
Okay, so it's in the capital, basically, where supplies themselves are extremely limited.
Extremely limited. And those cities now housing more than maybe 8 million or something, because a lot of people came back. I mean, when the war started, people just left to the States, and then life in the States became really hard, and they couldn't bear paying rents and stuff like that. You know, they said, well, I better live in my house where I don't have to pay rent. So a lot of people came out, like the south of the belt in Khartoum, as if there's no war. In Shambat, in El Kaderu, like just the north of Bahri, almost as if there's no war. Sherganil, Hajusif, like this place has been the same. People didn't leave. And they're relying on this, on the food that we provide. And in Omdurman, like, for example, just a week ago, people came back to Fetihab. Fetihab is adjacent to the Mohandisin area, which has been under siege since the war started. So people got evacuated from there, and then now they came back. You know, people are risking their lives just by being in Fetihab. Really, you're in the range of both warring parties.
Well, okay. And the situation, I imagine, in Khartoum must remain very desperate for those millions of people. Are there any services? What is life like in Khartoum right now after almost a year of war?
It's very desperate, and we're doing what we can with what we have. I mean, there is no electricity in most places. Some places they have. We helped in like restoring electricity and water, like Bahri, for example, and in Khartoum and Jiref. But we've been doing a lot with very little. It's just like a drop in a sea, really. Like it's not even close to the potential. It's not even close to the promises we've been getting. It's not even close to covering the actual needs on the ground.
Okay, so now I want to turn to Darfur, where some of the reports we're getting from humanitarian agencies are extremely harrowing about the hunger situation on the ground. What are you hearing from your people on the ground in Darfur about the situation right now?
In Darfur, most of the farmers didn't cultivate anything last year, and this is now the second year, the agricultural season is just upon us. It's Ramadan now. It's like by March. But they also can't cultivate, and that is a huge setback in the production, the agriculture production in Darfur. I mean, the entire Darfur is people, they rely on what they cultivate every year. So it's been 2 years they're off the season. That is definitely going to affect the whole region if we continue like that, because there's no stability now. Nobody can actually go to a farm and try to cultivate something, because it turned into a conflict, ethnic conflict between other tribes and stuff like that, and the RSF is still controlling, and their allied militias are there. So this is not going to be solved anytime soon. So the situation, as you can just draw from what I just explained, that, I mean, there's no food.
So in the areas you are operating, do you see a difference between areas that are held by one of the warring parties versus areas held by the other in terms of what it's like to live there as a Sudanese right now?
It's the same. I mean, it's war. So both parties you don't have any rights, really, living under SAFO or under RSF.
You're operating under very difficult circumstances in either case.
We have people detained all the time. People get questioned. People get sometimes injured and killed, too. Like, it's the sad truth, but that's the situation.
And in Jazeera, specifically, after RSF took Wad Madani, obviously there's been a lot of many reports about atrocities, very widespread looting. What have you guys heard about what the situation is like for people still inside the state who didn't flee?
In so many areas, there have been a lot of looting. There have been a lot of killing. Just last week, I think, in a couple of areas in South Al Jazeera, there's a group of RSF, like in uniform. I think they attacked and they took cars. They killed like 7 people. The looting has been, of course, a modality, and we've seen that in so many areas, you know, by RSF. They usually issue a statement saying these are some rogue elements and we are looking into it and stuff like that. But nonetheless, it's been happening everywhere. Everywhere there was an RSF attack, there was always afterwards, after they take the area, there's always looting.
So I think listeners will know, we have had a lot of public warnings about impending famine in Sudan, but declaring a famine technically requires quite a lot of data, mortality, nutrition data, and that data, for the most part, doesn't really exist for most of Sudan. So it's actually been very difficult to determine just how bad the situation is. So do you have any sense of a timeline for when a starvation crisis might hit the areas you're operating in? And what are you telling external actors?
We already have cases of malnutrition. We already have people died of malnutrition. The number is going to be rising. And in the couple of months, for example, if we could not get ahead of this, we don't want to get there. We don't want to get to when there is like thousands or hundreds of people died of malnutrition. Like right now, the food we are supplying is not enough. It doesn't cover the actual body needs. We give them lentils and rice. You know, there's no vegetables. There's no specific food for kids. Everybody eats the same food. I pray to God that we never get to that stage, but we're heading towards it, especially in Khartoum. If access is not allowed to people to be like shopkeepers and wholesalers, they have their ways of getting food into any situation. They know how to talk to like people at checkpoints, pay the money, whatever they do to get it in. But when they get it in, it's like, for example, you're suddenly buying a sack of rice for like, I don't know, like $150 or something from $20. So it's like, you know, because they paid a lot of money to buy the stuff, to ship it, and then any checkpoints will meet them, whether it's a SAF checkpoint or an RSF checkpoint, they have to pay the money. So they will have to factor all that into their calculations. And then it shows on the final bill, which is basically us at the ER when they buy the food.
So in Khartoum, are you guys in Greater Khartoum? Is there really anyone else operating, serving those millions of people?
Not really, no. There's MSF. MSF, I really give them a loud voice of thanks for what they've been doing in the south of the belt. But everybody else left, really. There's nobody.
Yeah, so besides MSF, which of course is, you know, supplies medical needs, in terms of the humanitarian response for other needs, including food, it's you.
Yeah.
Serving millions of people in the capital.
Yes, I wouldn't be like, I wouldn't say like 100%. Maybe there are some local, but everybody really is working through us. So most of these NGOs and local organizations are working through us. It's us, like first line responders.
And so you guys are not registered NGOs. You're not traditional aid actors. You obviously have an entire aid system, humanitarian system, which is essentially blocked. It's unable to get aid into many parts of Sudan, into the capital itself. So, you know, what have been your main challenges in actually getting support and aid in order to serve the millions of people trapped in Khartoum, but also elsewhere? What are the main challenges that you faced?
It's actually what you just said. I mean, the fact that we are not a registered organization, it makes donors think about the risk. And they always insist on working through either an intermediary organization or in a very, very small dosage of funding. But what people are forgetting is that this same reason of making the organization thinking about the risk is the same reason that is allowing us to operate. If we are a registered organization, we can be stopped easily by authorities. They can freeze our accounts. They can do whatever. This guerrilla approach we're using is the only reason we've been successful in doing what we're doing. We're not a centralized kind of setting, right? External communication is like foreign affairs. That's the committee that I'm part of. So we reach out to these organizations and we talk to them, tell them about the needs, and if we get a pledge or if you get funding, then we channel it through programs and to the finance, and then the finance channel it to separate rooms. And we've been working that way very successfully so far, but very, very little funding. Like the amount of funding we've got, the amount of actual donor money that we spent on the ground is maybe 2 million or less than.
Yeah. For anyone who's dealt with humanitarian responses, they know $2 million is a tiny drop in the bucket of a crisis like Sudan.
Exactly, for this entire huge operations. And the reason for that is, for example, if you get a pledge of $1 million from an organization, they have to channel it through an organization that will take, for example, a 700 overhead to do their own things or whatever. And then the actual money gets to the ERs like 200 or 300 or something like that.
Do you have capacity to operate at a much larger scale, or is there the limitation in how much donors could send through you if they wanted to send more?
We do have the capacity. We're just setting up a financial system, an online financial system, so that we can guarantee to donors that, okay, this is how this thing's going to work. And with us, Alan, is that we don't have expenses to pay. We don't have people salaries. We don't have anything, allowances for people, stuff like that. Like if you give us $100,000, all the $100,000 go to the ground, feeding people and doing the operation on the ground, because it's totally volunteer-based. For example, that, for some donors, that, well, creates more questions than it answers. Like, how are these people, you know, making money, right? And that's right. Not the question, actually, because in Sudan, we are accustomed to this nafir modality and this helping one another without asking for any money. I mean, I've been working for like a year now, you know, not just me, the entire 2,000 or 1,500 volunteers have been working because they have to, because nobody else will do this work if they didn't. And our systems are set up in a way that doesn't leave room for corruption. Nobody can make a decision by themselves.
Can you go into a bit more detail on what you mean by there's no corruption?
So, for example, if I meet crisis group, for example, and they said, okay, well, we will want to work with you in Khartoum and we want to give you guys $500,000. I do not receive that money. I will immediately, after this step, I will link them up with programs. So programs will design the intervention, and then programs includes finance, and then the money gets sent from the organization to the finance office. When the money enters the finance, the programs will follow up with the local EERs. The EERs will fill up something called an F1 form that has their needs. Programs will approve, and then finance will send the money to these individual ERs. Everybody knows, okay, in this ER, in our ER, we're receiving $10,000. So finance cannot just sit on $10,000. The minute the funding is released, we put all the documentation of the transaction on the larger group so that people everybody would know the representatives, the programs of this small ER, the kitchen coordinators. They know that, okay, in finance we have $10,000, and this is the documents of how this is going to get spent. And they decide to redesign, for example, well, if there is a bigger medical need, and we didn't allocate money for that, they actually sit down and they decide, okay, well, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take 20% of this funding, allocate it to the medical needs. And then they raise that to the big group as well. And everybody knows what's happening. We know how the money is being spent. Weekly data of the implementation will be sent to the reporting. And then the reporting group immediately put things into the tracker. Okay, I can open the tracker right now and I can see, okay, Kerry, for example, spent $1,000 in buying food supplies. So the tracker, it updates in real time.
Yeah, so you've essentially created your own novel accountability system, a sort of horizontal accountability system. You know, so I think it's, you know, as Sudan heads into possible or likely famine in areas, I think no one's saying that the emergency rooms are going to respond to that entire crisis. As you said, you only operate in certain areas, and obviously it's important to get food aid into the country externally as well. But I think it's worth everyone paying attention to the fact that you still feel very underfunded, mostly just because you don't operate in the way the aid industry is used to. I think anyone who's ever seen these aid responses up close knows that there's always a fair amount of diversions that take place, usually to armed groups who man checkpoints, and aid agencies and donors know very well that not everything that they're supplying is going to make its way to the people. So of course, even if they did have concerns about accountability, that, you know, that doesn't stop support in other contexts, or else no food would get to people in war zones. So anyways, I just wanted to mention those points as well. And you operate on both sides of this conflict. How have you managed to, obviously emotions are very high and views are very polarized on the war. How have you managed to keep politics out of what you guys are doing?
I mean, when we started, the goal was really simple. People need food and people need medicine. Some people need protection, evacuation. We're going to supply that. We have all shades of political parties in the ER. We may not agree on our political views, but we agree on one thing, which is, well, people need food on the ground. People need medicine, essential life-saving medicines. So how can we put this stuff aside and just talk about the work and how we do the work? And there's a lot of disagreements and stuff in meetings and stuff like that. But at the end, it's a democracy. So in a democracy, you have competing voices. And in the end, we have a process of solving any issue, and it just works.
And then finally, or almost finally, there obviously are not current peace talks right now on the war in Sudan, but if they do restart at some times, which, you know, they will eventually, do you think it's important for groups like yours to feel like they are somehow involved in that process or have a seat somewhere there? Or would you prefer that basically ceasefire talks, you know, that it doesn't involve the grassroots networks like you guys on the ground?
It's really helpful for us to be involved. I mean, we've been excluded so far from many efforts, but the work we've been doing that right now is like, it's not just a work, it's not just an organization, it's like a really work of a government. And we're not helpless. Like, the youth in Sudan are not helpless, are not pointless. They have something to say, and they should be included in these kind of discussions. I mean, if the war stops, it's all going to go back to these grassroots networks to rebuild the country and to contribute into the development of the country. Just like most of these talks are kind of, the politics, usually the voice of politics is higher than the voice of reason, really.
And within the ERs, do people see it as a network that would have a future beyond the war itself, whenever it ends? Does it feel like you're building something bigger than just a humanitarian response, and any ideas on what that might look like?
We've been having these discussions and these conversations right now about, okay, what is going to be our role? Should there be peace? And in terms of like at the beginning when we started, it was like, okay, what we're doing is we are working in places that the organizations can't work. So our aim was not to replace organizations or to get plugged in into this organization and industry, and we are aiming to like the localization agenda and the decolonization of the humanitarian aid. That, I mean, we're still trying to do that. I mean, that yet it's like it's still an issue because most organizations, they just kind of, we've been fitted into their system somehow, despite the fact that we're trying to not be, but we're still being treated as a project. Any organization work with us is treating the ERs as a project, and it's just like really creating all these delays of response on the ground. And our exit strategy was, okay, when organizations are allowed into these areas, that's it, we're done. But now that's not necessarily going to be the case. We're talking about how can we, we've been trying to work during the war. How can we contribute after the war, if there's peace, into development and redevelopment of these areas? So this conversation is still ongoing. And, you know, if we get something, we'll share it. I mean, our website, khartoumir.com, has every single thing. Everything is on our website and on our social media. And if we came into a conclusion of what our role, and if we define that role in the future, we will also put it in a writ, and we will put it in our website and share it around, because we also accept comments, correction, criticism, and all that.
Thank you so much for your time, Sanusi. I also know it's in the middle of Ramadan, in addition to all your other important duties. So thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. The Horn is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell, and our producers are Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nambi.